arrest and an increase in security, but May did not exploit this tragic and terrible event for electoral advantage. Indeed, campaigning for 2017 general election was suspended for 2 days after the attack. She certainly didn't echo the rhetoric of the far right, as Macron has done in France. Nor did she threaten to close down law-abiding Muslim organizations. The CCIF has no exact British equivalent, but it's as if May had made the Muslim Council of Britain illegal in the wake of the Manchester Arena bombing, even though it had nothing to do with the atrocity. Meanwhile, Macron's Interior Minister, Gérald Darmanin, has made a series of deeply provocative and sectarian remarks. He has accused the CCIF and other Muslim groups of being enemies of the Republic. This is the language of hate. Darmanin was widely criticized in October for expressing shock at halal food aisles while addressing the problem of separatism. Speaking to French TV, he said he had always been shocked to walk into a supermarket and see that there was an aisle of such community food. There is no question that Home Secretary Priti Patel is on the right of British politics, but she is yet to feel threatened by a halal supermarket aisle or accuse the Muslim Council of Britain of being an enemy of the British state. There is a major problem with Islamophobia at the grassroots level and among backbench conservative MPs. Last week, Michael Fabricant's warning to the Muslim Council of Britain that by exposing Islamophobia it was damaging Anglo-Muslim relations was an example of this and echoed President Macron's talk of Muslim separatism. When it comes to Muslims, President Macron has adopted the squalid policies of the far right. He has his own cynical reasons. He wants to win votes off Marine Le Pen. The fact that conservatives like O'Brien and Togolhat should praise this low and ugly politics is shocking. It shows how deeply institutional Islamophobia has now become embedded in the governing Conservative Party.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt, or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absat, to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist, who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon him the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemies' malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris. One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch, where what I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. president in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK, as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation? But the question is, just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation? Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker than ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that Little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British Mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it. They play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another 6-month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around 1/5 of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Saudi Arabia's use of American diplomatic cover and weapons alike has taken on a fevered pace as the kingdom deepens the tragedy it has inflicted upon Yemen, says Ahmad Abdul Karim Ryder in an article published under the heading, Yemen, Trump is showering Saudi Arabia with last-minute gifts. Stay tuned for the details, please. While the administration of Donald Trump readies its exit from the White House and the West Asia region, Saudi Arabia's use of American diplomatic cover and weapons alike has taken a fevered pace as the kingdom deepens the tragedy it has inflicted upon Yemen, where millions of forgotten people are struggling against a cold winter, starvation, epidemics, and the worst blockade in the modern era. Since November 3, 2020, when the 59th quadrennial presidential election began, followed by the widespread controversy, lawsuits, and recounts across several states, the oil-rich kingdom has waged a scorched-earth campaign against the Yemeni districts of Ma'arib, Al-Jawf, as well as border areas in Sana'a, Sa'deh, Hajja, Amran, and Hudaida. Recently, Saudi warplanes struck populated neighborhoods in Sana'a with at least 20 airstrikes. One person was killed and dozens were injured, and a number of purebred Arabian horses were killed in the strikes that hit a military college near Souq al-Rawda. Seven airstrikes hit government buildings located near water pumps. Thousands of tons of Western weapons, particularly from the United States of America, were also dropped on multiple directorates across the provinces of Sa'deh, Ma'arib, and Al-Jawf, as well as districts and provinces across the country. The unjustified escalation, which came on the back of a brief period of hope that briefly preceded the U.S. pre-election, was not only a last-minute gift to Saudi Arabia from the Trump administration before he leaves the White House in January, but also served to prevent the advance of the Yemeni army supported by the Ansarullah movement and tribal fighters in the oil-rich province of Ma'arib. On the Yemen-Saudi border, an intense Saudi bombing campaign aims to force the remaining residents in the area to flee. Saudi Arabia seeks to establish buffer zones on the border inside Yemeni territory in anticipation of any developments made by the incoming U.S. administration after Riyadh failed to achieve that goal through indirect negotiations with Sana'a, sources told Mint Press. In retaliation for Saudi escalation, the Yemeni army and Ansarullah movement targeted Saudi Arabia's vital oil sector, striking an oil facility in the kingdom Red Sea city of Jeddah. The facility was targeted by the high-precision Quds II winged missile, a new generation of locally made winged missiles that recently entered service after successful test. In the wake attack, videos circulated on social media show a column of smoke rising from burning flames at the facility as sirens of emergency vehicles can be heard in the background. The move just days before news was leaked that the British government secretly sent British soldiers to protect Saudi oil facilities in the wake of a similar attack in 2009 and occurred the day after the kingdom hosted a virtual summit of G20 nations. The spokesman for Yemen's Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Asari, said in a statement recently, in the wake of the attack, that the Saudi oil facility was targeted in response to ongoing Saudi military operations and blockade. He warned foreign companies operating in Saudi Arabia to avoid vital installations which could be involved in ongoing operations. The strike was meant to send a signal to both Saudi Arabian regime and the Zionist regime, according to officials in Sana'a. The strike against the Aramco facility, located more than 390 miles from Yemen's border, underscores Yemen's increasing ability to hit targets deeper inside Saudi Arabia with cruise and ballistic missiles as well as drones. A high-ranking source in Sana'a told Mint Press that the consequences of any insane recklessness by Saudi Arabia, the Zionist regime, or the current U.S. administration in the last time of Trump's term will be dire to Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and the interests of their allies in the region. When pressed, he gave no additional details. An explosion took place as a result of a terrorist attack by a projectile, causing a fire in a fuel tank at the petroleum products distribution terminal in the north of Jeddah, the Saudi Energy Ministry said in a statement. Recently, Abdullah Al-Ghamdi, the manager of the North Jeddah bulk plant, told reporters during a tour of the facility that one of the 13 tanks used for diesel oil, gasoline, and jet fuel at the facility had been damaged and was out of service, adding the attack had been similar to what happened at Khurais and Ababeh. As the kingdom's policy since 2015, when its war began, Saudi Arabia sold the attack to the world as targeting international interest. The kingdom went further and baselessly accused Ansarullah movement of attacking an oil tanker in the Red Sea. A Maltese-flagged oil tanker managed by Greece was damaged due to an explosion near Shoghaig in southwestern Saudi Arabia, but Ansarullah has not yet claimed responsibility for the incident. Prior to that, the Saudi-led coalition claimed recently that it had removed and destroyed five naval mines in southern Red Sea. 15 Saudi troops, including officers, were killed or injured in another retaliatory attack, this one marking the Saudi-led coalition Tadawain camp in Ma'arib, 20 kilometers east Sana'a, according to Brigadier Yahya Al-Sari, spokesperson of the Yemeni army. Ansari said in a statement recently that missile forces hit the joint operations room of a coalition camp in Ma'arib, killing 8 Saudi troops and injuring 7. He added that Yemeni forces are observing enemy movements and will target them wherever they are. In the wake of Ansari's announcement, Saudi state media announced that Saudi troops were killed in battle with no mention of where or when they were killed. For his part, Mohammed Abdul Salam, spokesperson for Ansarullah, said that Saudi wailing following every painful retaliation is what is required. He added, the international community has to pressure Saudi Arabia regime to stop the aggression and the blockade because the Yemeni people deserve to voice their suffering too. Yemen suffers from the world's worst humanitarian crisis sparked by 5 years of Saudi regime bombing and blockade supported by the United States of America. The humanitarian crisis has worsened this year as international donations have dried up and the Trump administration has suspended aid to the north of Yemen where most of the country's population lives. The UN, the Secretary General warned last week that Yemen faces the worst famine in decades, saying that the country is in imminent danger and that without immediate action, millions of lives may be lost. U.S. policy in Yemen has been a disgrace for the past 5 years, drawing ire on U.S. soil and from abroad. And few Yemenis were surprised that the Trump administration would enact such a policy on its way out the door after having already suspended aid to 80% of the population residing in north of the country. The lives of millions of vulnerable children in Yemen are already at risk. This policy will only deepen their suffering by further restricting humanitarian access to vulnerable communities. Recent evidence continues to point to a worsening malnutrition crisis for children, said Janti Soprito, the president and CEO of Save the Children. Even if a humanitarian exemption is permitted, this designation will likely make reaching children and families more difficult and could also heighten security risks for staff and hinder the fragile peace process.
Inside Israel.
Between 80,000 to 85,000 Israeli businesses are estimated to go out of business this year. That's an 85% rise since last year. Israeli businesses are desperate just to keep open and pay their liabilities, let alone earn an income.
People just want to fight for the right to provide, for the right to give the future for the children. What we are talking about, this is what they want, these small businesses. They don't have power to talk with the government. They don't have power to do nothing. Just they want to fight for the right of them.
Now, Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. Israel just got out of a second coronavirus lockdown in 2020. Many businesses were forced to shut down without compensation, leaving them exposed to financial risks. Many of them succumbed to those risks and have already closed. According to a survey published by U.S.-based business analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, in the first half of the year, 37,600 businesses in Israel closed, including 1,500 cafes and restaurants and around 450 clothing and shoe stores. The number of closures in the first half of 2020 represents a 70% jump compared to the number of closures in 2019. The restaurant, construction, and transportation industries are among the worst hit, along with fashion stores. Before the coronavirus crisis, Israel had more than 14,000 restaurants, but after the first lockdown, that number fell below 12,000. Business owners say that this lockdown is catastrophic, as Israel went into the first lockdown not knowing what its results would be, but now they know they're destructive. The results of people coming in and out of quarantine and lockdowns are payments withheld, projects stalled, cash flow has ceased, and business owners cannot cover paychecks. According to the Israeli Hotel Association, instead of fighting the coronavirus and developing the economy, the regime has developed the virus and fought the economy. The regime's failure of passing a budget for 2020 has added unnecessary uncertainty in the face of the crisis. It is essential that a budget capable of adapting the tools at the disposal of the central bank to current challenges be approved as quickly as possible, according to the Israeli Central Bank. The political crisis between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his now coalition partner and military minister Benny Gantz has succeeded in yielding no agreement on a budget.
So the atmosphere really among business owners here in Israel is really despair. The business owners have lost a significant amount of their income, of their livelihoods. And unlike people who are employed, business owners actually have a set amount of expenses that are still there, that they still have to pay. In addition to the lack of income that they have. So their crisis, their economic crisis and their economic struggle is actually greater, in addition to the fact that the government doesn't have the same benefits and the same income security for freelance workers and for business owners. Business owners really have, I think, we can't really generalize, but I think the main sentiment towards what the government has been done is that they feel like they have been neglected, like they are not seen, like they are really just on the margin of the priorities of the government and of the authorities. I think everyone can say that. Everyone that lost their jobs can say that they are marginalized, that they are not being seen, and that there are no real solutions happening to these people. However, for business owners, that's especially true because most business owners actually lost lost any kind of source of income, and there are almost zero solutions provided by the government and by the new policies that are being enacted for the COVID-19 crisis. The estimate, I think, the latest estimate is that one out of five small businesses, will close due to the pandemic. That's 20% of businesses, and that's 20% of families. That's tens of thousands of families that are not only losing their income, they're also losing, you know, their ability to actually secure any kind of income in the future. The uncertainty that this pandemic has presented to us has been unprecedented. We don't have actually any answers. We don't have a certainty of when this will end. We don't know when businesses will actually go back to normal. So that's a much harder crisis, a much harder situation to deal with as a business owner, and because it's not like you have a certain period of time where you don't have a certain income and then you can plan accordingly.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Mark says this regime has killed many businesses, ruined many lives, and has probably caused a massive rise in crime. It has created normalization with others while neglecting normalization at home. Corruption, lies, and deceit are being reported. Where there is smoke, there must be fire. Arlene says synagogues open some schools, but Likud party Israel Katz, referring to Israeli Finance Minister Katz, and Netanyahu did what they could to injure without supporting business owners, shopkeepers, restaurants and cafes, the elderly, the poor, the families. The virus is not over yet. More lockdowns will be the future. Avi says Israeli Finance Minister Katz is a disgrace. The Israeli regime needed to provide financial compensation to the businesses harmed while incentivizing them to preserve public health. Columbus Jewish News says some large retail merchandise chains and small shops in Israel are defying the regime's restrictions and opening their doors in protest against the regime's lockdown, which has been disastrous for the economy and individual business owners.
Well, it looks like they've been very, very badly hit. The real problem is the strong divisions within Israeli society and the extraordinary concern by Netanyahu about international politics and his lack of real attention to a program for resuscitating and attending to the needs of the basic Israeli society.
Israel's decision in September to impose a second nationwide lockdown after a resurgence in coronavirus infections has dealt a hammer blow to the economy and the livelihoods of small business owners. Although the lockdown has ended, restaurants and other public places are not allowed to open. The Israeli regime is gradually allowing some to open and imposing fines for those that challenge the regime. Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. One of the organizers of this initiative is known as Lo Yehyeh Beseger, meaning there will be no lockdown in the Israeli Hebrew language. It has called on all small business owners in Israel to open their stores and services to the public. It was founded by a group of small business owners a few months ago and has since gained about 60,000 members over Facebook. It is not clear so far how many businesses have joined the rebellion. However, many stores and other small businesses considered non-essential during the pandemic have continued to operate in secret, behind curtains, or have closed doors, defying regime orders. Unrest is growing among small business owners who demand that their operations be allowed to resume right now. During the latest lockdown in Israel, small businesses were left with two choices: rebel against regime orders or tell their landlords they cannot make rent. Many worry that these restrictions will once more intensify. Business owners believe that the regime doesn't understand that businesses will fail another month like this, and according to Israeli media, it'll all be over. People who have nothing to lose will stay open.
Government actually has done close to nothing to help the people, to help the people and the business owners and employers and employees and everyone that actually has been impacted by this pandemic, economically, socially, and politically. I think the government has really been very, very, very negligent. It's been very disconnected from the needs of the people. It's been very preoccupied with other things. We can see that, you know, many tycoons and millionaires are getting millions of shekels in tax exemptions and tax discounts, where this money could go very easily to education, to health, to welfare, and to business owners. And I think that the fact that this government has failed in really coping with this pandemic and with this crisis really also represents the bigger picture of the system and of the priorities of this government. It's not, the pandemic didn't create the problems. I think it just put the problems on the front where we could actually see them very clearly. It surfaced the problems. It surfaced the years and years of neglecting, of under-budgeting for the different systems that we have. So now we're after the end of a partial end of the second closure. And I think that you could see that smaller businesses are starting to open again. What is sad is that you see that not all of them are opening. If you go just right down here on Mikveh Israel in Tel Aviv, right under our office, you could see that, you know, there are, I think, around 10 shops in the street here, and you could see that two of them actually closed completely. They just didn't make it. And it's very, very sad to see that, to think that this small business belonged to a family, belonged to a mother or to a father, and they just lost their income. They lost their business, and they probably have had that business for years. So some businesses actually did decide to protest and open their businesses despite the closure, despite the instructions of not opening them. And that's also because they are, it's a sign of protest. It's a sign of, you know, we're not agreeing with these policies. You cannot choose our health over our livelihood or our livelihood over our health. The government's responsibility is to make sure that we are also healthy, which absolutely justifies the closures and the limitations. However, when you decide to do that, it's the government's responsibility and it should be its priority to make sure that these people do not starve, that the people who are affected by these closures do not actually lose their source of income.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Handicapper Bill says Netanyahu screwed up like his bosom buddy Trump. A2P says even before the coronavirus pandemic, Israel had one of the largest income gaps and poverty rates. A second nationwide virus lockdown has widened those gaps, dealing a new blow to an economy already hit hard by the first round of restrictions. Avi says restaurants also had a responsibility to act responsibly. Too many did not extend outdoor seating, did not have them or staff wear masks, and did not take health or safety measures. Yes, they should have an economic safety net, but they need to take responsibility as well. According to Anne, what is the evidence people were getting sick in restaurants? We have no data. Infuriating.
The Bibi regime has taken over so much of our solidness, our proper life, livelihood here in this country, and we don't feel like we have democracy anymore. We feel that for escaping the law, is going to be stuck there, and we're going to be stuck forever in a state of some kind of a new monarchy. That's what we feel we have here.
No, we have to separate between the protest, which is growing and which is now lasting for many, many weeks, which is namely directed at Netanyahu and has namely to do with the charges of corruption that he is confronting. This is one episode. Corona and business who cannot open or rebellious is another episode. They not necessarily mix together. The core or the majority of the protests against Netanyahu, the demonstrations which take place almost every evening and for sure every weekend, those protests are mainly political protests against Netanyahu without any connection to the economy or to the pandemic.
Israel is slowly opening up businesses again, but it's been months since they were required to close that it won't have meaningful impact on the economy. Israel's GDP contracted by 28.7% in the second quarter of 2020. That is the sharpest decline in 40 years, according to a report released by the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics. This while private consumption fell 43.4% in the second fiscal quarter. Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio in 2020 is expected to reach some up to 80%. In September, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, forecast that Israel's economy is expected to contract 6% this year. Israel's economy was showing signs of instability even before the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, there was a political deadlock for about a year that shook the economy, and then the pandemic dealt the final blow. For now, many Israelis say that they've lost hope and trust in the regime and its failure to help them. Here's the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. Some 22.7% of Israelis, 938,000 people, were unemployed at the height of the second coronavirus lockdown, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics, Calculus reported. The statistics refer to the first half of October and are based on a poll of the workforce. Ynet News. Israeli Knesset member Betalel Smutrich called for Israel to apply sovereignty over the occupied West Bank before the next U.S. presidential term begins, in the event Democrat nominee Joe Biden wins the 2020 presidential elections. Polls say over 60% of Israelis favor the Republican president over Biden, the former vice president in the Obama administration. I-24 News. Israeli armed forces destroyed the homes of some 80 Palestinians it said were built without permit in the occupied West Bank. The United Nations has called the move the largest demolition operation conducted in over a decade. Bulldozers knocked down livestock enclosures, portable toilets, solar panels, and water containers in an operation that stretched into the night. Globes. Israel's fiscal deficit reached 10.1% of GDP for the 12 months to the end of October, the Ministry of Finance announced. This represents a rise of about 1% from September. The cumulative deficit for January to October 2020 is 122.7 billion new Israeli shekels. In the corresponding period last year, the deficit totaled 37.8 new Israeli shekels. The Ministry of Finance said in response to the deficit figure, the regime's expenditure has risen, tax revenues have fallen, among other things, contributed to the large deficit.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
According to Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S., more than 50 million people will experience food insecurity by the end of the year. Among U.S. children, the figure rises to 1 in 4. The group, which runs a network of some 200 food banks across the nation, says it distributed over 500 million meals last month alone, a 52% increase from an average pre-pandemic month. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Hunger Like They Have Never Seen It Before. U.S. food banks struggle as 1 in 6 families with children don't have enough to eat. Here's the details of this article. One in six U.S. families with children don't have enough to eat this holiday season, a national emergency exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic and the unemployment crisis it has generated. Over the past several days, remarkable reporting in the Washington Post and National Geographic, among other outlets, has explored this alarming trend. According to Feeding America, the largest hunger relief organization in the U.S., more than 50 million people will experience food insecurity by the end of the year. Among U.S. children, the figure rises to 1 in 4. The group, which runs a network of some 200 food banks across the nation, says it distributed over 500 million meals last month alone, a 52% increase from an average pre-pandemic month. The latest U.S. Census Bureau pandemic survey, published earlier this month, found that fewer than half of U.S. households with children were very confident they could afford to provide enough food for their families in the next month. As is so often the case when it comes to matters of economic inequality, Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities are disproportionately impacted by the hunger crisis. Among the 25 U.S. counties experiencing the worst food insecurity, only 4 have majority white populations, all of them in rural Kentucky. Census Bureau data reveals that fully 27% of Black and 23% of Latino households with children reported not having enough to eat over the past week, compared with just 12% of white families. This is a story about racial and ethnic disparities, both food insecurity and the story of coronavirus. Emily Engelhard, Managing Director of Feeding America Research Unit, told National Geographic. The populations and geographies that started in the most disadvantageous state of food insecurity are the ones that are getting hit the hardest during the pandemic. People are seeing hunger like they've never seen it before. Trisha Cunningham, president of the North Texas Food Bank, where cars lined up for miles and people slept in their vehicles waiting for Thanksgiving food boxes, told National Geographic. On November 14th, its busiest day on record, North Texas Food Bank provided groceries, including 7,000 whole turkeys, to more than 25,000 people.